you've been away from this country for a while, not a stranger, but living elsewhere. What's it like to come back and be a resident in your homeland again?
Well, I'm still in exile. I mean, I've been exiled to Britain to do any real investigative reporting. I still have to work for the BBC television. I'm doing a documentary, The Bush Dynasty, with heavy investigative material on these characters. The chance of being seen on U.S. television, close to zero. So I'm kind of an internal exile now. I've moved from being physically exiled to London to being internally exiled, where it's very, very difficult to get my stories out here.
What do you make of the political landscape now that you're surrounded by it again?
Actually, kind of exciting. Protest and action and organizing on a scale I haven't seen since the war in Vietnam. For example, right now I'm doing a petition drive at Martin Luther King III, Working Assets and Southern Christian Leadership Conference to stop the Bush family from stealing the election of 2004 like they stole it in 2000. You know, between electronic voting and electronic and computerization of the voter registry files state by state under a brand new federal law that kind of just snuck through, you know, we're putting together a nationwide petition on that. But this is amazing because it's involving unions and civil rights groups and progressive groups of all types. I mean, it's a type of ferment that we haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, along those lines, I was surprised, not to demean your talents by any means, but I was surprised to see your book in the New York Times bestseller list. We've got Michael Moore in the Times bestseller list. I've got 30-year-old books by Noam Chomsky selling like hotcakes. At a time when, you know, Bush's approval ratings are supposed to be very high and we're all united in our patriotism and devotion to our leader, well, what's going on? How do you read these contradictions?
Well, two things. One, Bush's popularity is a mile wide and about a half inch deep. He, like his daddy, who had 90% approval ratings, once people took down the yellow ribbons, he was gone because, people aren't going to put up with losing their 401k pension plans evaporating and the economy going to the toilet. Now, the rise of Michael Moore's book, my own book on, you know, for over 11 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, Noam Chomsky, the only reason he's not on a bestseller list is the New York Times redefined bestsellers to exclude Chomsky's 9/11. And this is happening because people just can't get any damn information on mainstream U.S. television or radio. I mean, you know, thank God for Doug Henwood. Besides, you know, I'm not trying to just kiss your lapels, but it's like, you know, where are you going to hear this stuff? I am on the top of the BBC Nightly News, the biggest network on this planet, goes worldwide. I write for the most influential paper in the world, The Guardian. And, man, you can't, I'd have to take hostages to get this stuff into the U.S. press. I mean, there's a little exception, you know, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, despite their almost visceral distaste for my work, did run a piece by Martin Luther King and I just because they just couldn't say no. But for the most part, people are just really hungry for real information about the Bushes, about the economy, about corporate America, and, you know, that's what's happening. People are just really hungry for information that they can't get. I mean, these are reports. I mean, it's weird. These are reports that I write for the front page of the big paper of Europe. And you don't see them. They're on page zero in America. And I feel almost bad that people have to buy a book to get this information when they really should be able to just, you know, flip open the Daily Rag or turn on the tube and get the full story.
Well, of course, there is the internet now to get people to get around the official media. You alluded earlier to what's going on, plans for the 2004 election. You, of course, broke some important material about the 2000 election, particularly the theft in Florida. But what do the Bush gang have in store for the next election?
They have no shame. You know, in 2000, the real story, which is what I put in the paper in Britain and described in the book, is that 5 months before the election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush knock off 57,000 voters off the voter rolls. So we thought. Now I know it's 94,000 or more off the voter rolls on the grounds that these were felons, illegal voters. Turns out they were not felons. They were simply guilty of voting while black. They had names that were similar to felons. That's how this president was chosen. Rather than say that Florida system, which was unique to Florida, computerizing and purging the voter rolls, should never be repeated anywhere. Instead, they have passed something called, Congress passed something called the Help America Vote Act. And look out when, you know, the Republicans.
It's like the clear skies proposal.
Yes, right. Like, look out when they're about to help us vote. This is going to require every state of the union to repeat the Florida game of centralizing, computerizing all their voter rolls and allowing one politico, the Secretary of State, 49 other Catherine Harrises, to purge the voter rolls, supposedly to prevent voter fraud. And, baby, this means hundreds of thousands of black people will be wiped out because that's the easiest voter to identify. In many states, the race is put right on the computerized voter rolls by law. And so we're seeing a massive reduction of black voters through just the kind of what I'd call the neutron bomb of election politics, cleansing the voter rolls.
So are we going to see Florida multiplied by 50?
You betcha. We're going to see in some states, well, Florida itself is going to be another horror show. The big swing states, I'm worried about Pennsylvania, Tennessee. I'm worried about Georgia. And from the Democratic side, look out for Illinois. See, that's why the Democrats went along with this little scam, because they have states that they control. All politics is local, and they like the idea that in some states they will have their finger on the nuclear eraser for voter rolls.
Now, a lot of people have speculated about replacing the old mechanical voting machines and ballot boxes with computers is going to leave the thing wide open to fraud. What do you think of that?
Well, imagine gatesifying your entire voting system. We had David Dill, who's the head of computer sciences at Stanford, got a hold of me and said, "My God, Greg, you have to do something to stop them from computerizing the voting systems nationwide." He's now getting together a petition of computer sciences professors saying, "Don't do this to us. You know, we don't want to put our democracy in the hands of Windows." Even more important is that the particular systems that they're using are virtual invitations to fraud. The number one company is called ES&S. Not only is that Chuck Hagel's, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel's old company out of Nebraska, where there's some funny voting going on with those machines, but the front person for that organization is a woman named Sandra Mortham. And now Sandra Mortham is the woman she founded Women for Jeb Bush in his recent campaign election, and she was Catherine Harris's predecessor, another Jeb Bush hack, who began the purge of black voters in Florida. In other words, the woman that created the Florida disaster is now the woman who is bringing us electronic voting.
Well, the Bush administration has been very busily talking about how they're going to bring their brand of democracy to Iraq, so that might be a good linchpin here to talk about what their plans are for the occupation of that country. We hear constantly, for example, that Iraq's oil will be for the benefit of the Iraqi people. Now, you've gotten a look at what they're planning for the reconstruction of Iraq. Could you give us a hint of what you've seen?
Yeah, I'll give you a hint because they won't. There's a 100-page document, which is still secret, which is called Rebuilding Iraq. It's the inside State Department document, which I have a copy of, and I want to credit the Wall Street Journal because they first got a copy and ran one story. But now I've looked through it, and it calls for mass privatization of all of Iraq's assets at one shot, including sell-off of the oil fields. And it goes into great detail. We're turning Iraq into a free fire, free market zone. Let me give you some examples of specificity. There is nothing, by the way, in the plan about a constitution for Iraq, nothing about a legislature, but there is detailed plans for rewriting that nation's tax laws, detailed plans for rewriting and basically eliminating all their trade restrictions. This is the program for Iraq. For example, I do know that of those who have had a hand in this, there's, for example, Hillary Rosen. She's the chief lobbyist for the Recording Industry of America. And what that means is that before, Iraqis had a worry that Saddam's secret police would hear them listening to protest songs. Now they have to worry that Sony's lawyers will hear them listening to bootleg Madonna albums. Now, why we are rewriting the copyright laws of Iraq for them? We are changing their tax system over to a regressive VAT sales tax system from an income tax system. I mean, it is, and of course we're imposing new taxes because if you take away their oil industry, which has provided the nation's income, you are now going to have to tax the average Iraqi Joe on the street. You know, Ahmed is now going to get a tax bill, and that's so we can get rid of their oil industry and sell it off to. There's only four oil companies that could possibly buy it: Exxon, Shell, Phillips Texaco, and Royal Dutch.
Did they say anything about the French and Russians already have concessions in Iraq?
Well, the French and Russians can skip it because they won't be able to bid for this. They have no cash. I mean, what's going to happen is that oil will be expanded. The French and Russians will get their deals cut. I'm not worried about the French and Russians. People talk about the UN or other nations being involved in reconstruction. The real issue is that Iraqis are not being involved in the reconstruction of their own country and being given no hand in determining their own rules and regulations.
Who's writing these plans? Who's the grand plan master for Iraq now?
Well, the grand plan is coming officially out of USAID, but again, this is a secret document. They're not showing you, Doug, or the Iraqis, God forbid, what's going to happen to them. So it's quite detailed. And you have people rewriting the tax code like Grover Norquist, who is a lobbyist for Microsoft and American Express.
So the Bush administration is basically getting its dream experiment on Iraq, what they'd like to do to us.
Well, they have openly said that their guide is not. Now, this is very interesting, and you've seen it already in an article by Thomas Friedman saying that you need the software before you need the hardware. In other words, you need free institutions, which they consider free markets and elimination of government regulations and sell-off of government properties before you have what they call the hardware of democracy, which is elections. In other words, free market before elections, and therefore you need some type of transitional government. And the particular model that they're referencing right now is the transition to democracy created by General Pinochet of Chile.
What do you make of it? What it looked like a lot of disarray in their plans for Iraq, and shifting personnel like crazy, and it's only been a little bit more than a month. Yet they've got this very detailed plan of what they're going to do. I mean, are they just trying to get the right people, or is there something going on there that we can't see?
There's a lot of internal struggle. For example, they had as the effective mayor of Baghdad a woman named Barbie Bodine. She came across my screen a couple of years ago because, if you note, there's a section in my book called Did Bush Spike the Investigation of Bin Laden and Saudi Arabian Financing of Terrorism? It's a big story that I did for BBC. And part of that story was about John O'Neill, who was the main guy for the FBI hunting al-Qaeda. He was blocked in his investigation of al-Qaeda in Yemen when he was investigating al-Qaeda's killing sailors on the USS Cole. He was blocked in that investigation by Ambassador Barbie Bodine. So she's part of the kind of Saudi crowd, the Saudi protection operation, which is, by the way, very interesting because when Barbie became the effective mayor of Baghdad, for the first time, George Bush finally had evidence of someone in the Iraqi government who had protected al-Qaeda. Which is, of course, what we were looking for once he put her in charge. But then she went because apparently she wasn't part of the Kissinger crowd, as is our new military dictator that we've assigned to Iraq. And so the original junta was Boudin, Garner, and another U.S. general. Now the Kissinger crowd is moving in because as we move from military to the economic operation, the economic mop-up operation.
Do you think, I mean, there's certainly a lot of people are talking about this, the Iraq was just the first step in a long plan, and of course I think Karl Rove the other week said something about how, corrected somebody, referred to the war in Iraq as it was a battle within a 50-year war. Do you think that their ambitions extend beyond Baghdad to further beyond the region?
Oh, way beyond. I agree. It's all war, all the time economy. I think that their strategy is they figure Poppy Bush made his mistake in winning his war too quickly and sliding into the peace issues of keeping us all employed where he loses. What I'm very concerned about is not even so much the hot wars, the attacks like as in the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm concerned about the new economic Cold War. For example, the attack on Venezuela. In fact, a new section of my book is about the attempts of the U.S. government with a small elite within Venezuela to seize control of that nation. Now, let's put it this way. The U.S. now has a vote in OPEC through its control of Iraq. I mean, basically, this guy from Kissinger Associates now has a vote in OPEC. But there's no sense having a vote in OPEC if it's going to be canceled out by Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. So he is really their next target. They're very concerned about Latin America. They're very concerned about control in the Congo, where there's a lot of where they have to be concerned about natural resources there. And so I'm very concerned about the wars we're not seeing and are not being covered, and we don't have CNN embedded in bed with the Pentagon.
Well, yeah, you've written about Venezuela. You visited it. What can you say about the way our press covered events there?
Well, our press didn't cover it. They covered it up. I mean, some of the most horrendous reporting. The New York Times, which just has been preening all this past couple of weeks about the fact they uncovered one of their reporters for writing phony stories. And it's a pretense. It's pretending that the rest of their stories are truthful. Well, let me give you one about Venezuela. They actually ran pictures more than once, about three times already, showing demonstrations in Venezuela against President Chavez. And I can tell you, the one that they ran in June was absolutely honest. The picture was there. These people were protesting against Hugo Chavez, the president, 100,000 people. What they didn't tell you is that there was a demonstration twice as big on the other side of town in favor of the progressive populist Hugo Chavez. So you literally got Stalinized news out of the New York Times. But they were just, you know, one, just like every other paper in America, which was using stringers from Reuters and the AP who happened to also be working for the guys that were plotting the coup. So literally you have coup plotters against the president of Venezuela who are giving us the news, and it's being reprinted in U.S. papers as stone-cold truth. It's horrendous, the half-baked, Stalinized reporting we're getting. The difference between the New York Times and Izvestia is that in Russia, no one believed Izvestia.
Yeah, there's the illusion of independence, right? You got a book in the bestseller list, and so without any reviews in any major magazine or newspaper, how'd you get around the unofficial censorship that operates in American media?
We got around it by going sneaking under it and over it. Michael Moore tells everyone to read my book, and he's got it on the homepage of his website. Same with Arianna Huffington. The Pacifica radio stations, God bless them, you know, are getting the word out one way or the other. Free speech radio, Amy Goodman. You know, and I like to make the point that one of the things I'm doing is I'm on this, like, major campaign with Jim Hightower and others to support the alternative media. It shouldn't be alternative. This should be the media. And so I've kind of surprised, stunned, and at times upset my big corporate publishers by saying that my entire book tour has been turned over to raising money for the Pacifica radio stations and alternative media. I'm giving, you know, free books. They're part of my agreement with them is that they must give free books for Pacifica to sell and raise money, and I give videotapes of some of my work. And because we have to say, we can't be dependent. I mean, the so-called mainstream media is like an open information sewer pipe running into your home. And you just got to, you know, if you had sewage running into your house from an open pipe, you'd shut it off. Well, if you got news crap flowing into your home, you got to shut it off. But then you need some, you know, you need a source of sustenance, and the source of sustenance is the alternative radio.
Should those of us in the margins just essentially give up on trying to change the mainstream media and try to nurture our own institutions? Is it really hopeless to try to change the New York Times and the other big corporate outlets?
Oh, it may be hopeless, but it's like any other task of progressives, that we have no choice. We have to try to change them. And one way is to show them that we've got markets. For example, the reason my book is on the bestseller list, it was picked up by a big, giant corporate publishing house, is that they're afraid of missing the next stupid white men. You know, they try not to review us. They try not to allow us on the air, but they're getting stuck because the money's there. The money's there. And we have to make sure that we keep challenging these critters.
You hear all these things, it's easy to fall into despair, but let's try to conclude on a more hopeful note. Does the Bush crowd have a complete lock on power? You mentioned great popular movements developing. Is there some hope for getting out from under the Bush lash?
Well, frankly, I don't think they stand a chance. Just like Daddy, I think that they're going to be desperate in 2004. That's why they're computerizing voting systems. If they don't get, you know, you may have already voted, they just haven't told you how. You know, they're going to have a tough time winning it straight up. The other thing is that, you know, the election laws are getting so fixed that supposed campaign finance reform was a nightmare. Nevertheless, what that's doing is by eliminating such things as soft money, which the Democratic Party was completely dependent on, like an addict. You're going to see institutions change where people are going to have to go to the grassroots to get decent people elected, and you're going to see more people in the streets and more movements. I think right now there is a kind of, there's a popular momentum which is saying we've had enough, and I'm seeing it. My God, the AFL-CIO came out against the war in Iraq. I mean, that's like the earth moving, baby. When we're talking about movements springing up, whether it's black people saying we want to vote and we're not going to take it anymore, or union people saying no, we're not going to be war fodder anymore, at or just employees, you know, ex-employees of Enron saying where's our pensions and we're going to fight over it. Yeah, I think that there is a real chance of digging an electoral hole for these guys.